Oktoberfests, birthday fests, finally raked fests. Whatever fests they're celebrating this fall, give them gifts that they'll actually want, like drinks, and get them all from Drizly, an app for alcohol delivery. With Drizly, you can compare prices on bountiful cornucopias of beer, wine, and spirits, then get them all delivered to their door or the pile of leaves they're sitting in. So download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's drizly.com and get gifting today.
I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show. CBS Audio Network. David Grantham's book is Consequences, an intelligence officer's war. He not only survived Bagram Air Base, where IEDs had killed his predecessor, but he survived Iraq Zarqawi. David, did you know Zarqawi's reputation when you arrived? Did you believe it? Did everybody understand he was Murder Times 10 Incorporated and he was working intimately with the Iraqi people? Did you know that?
When we got there, we knew that. When I first arrived in theater in January 2006, I knew of him. And the turning point, and I mentioned this in the book, was the bombing of the Golden Dome Mosque in Iraq. It was it's a Shia holy site, very renowned in the Shia side of Islam. And when they bombed that mosque, when I say they, what it later was known to be Zarqawi, who was a Sunni al-Qaeda, that was a turning point. And I saw that. That was in February. About 4 weeks later, 6 weeks later, I am in Iraq at Camp Buka. We're now very well aware of who he is and his bloodthirsty approach to war. So we knew at that point that this was going to be a very, very significant fight against him, not only because he was attacking American forces, but because he was really fueling a burgeoning civil war between the Sunni and Shia in Iraq.
Right. You have a prison at Camp Buka, and you make a decision about how you're going to house the most radical of the detainees. We know now, many years later, that one of those detainees, not at your prison, at another prison in Iraq, turned out to be the man whom we know is credited to be the founder of ISIS. Did you understand the threat of the radicals recruiting inside that prison at the time?
We did. The information that came out of the prison and the intelligence we gained on those who had left and were in the field now, we knew then that the radicalization in the prison was ongoing and very significant. And the best thing the military could do at that time was simply divide in hopes that the radicalized would only congregate with the already radicalized. And therefore, they were merely reinforcing each other. The greatest fear was if a radicalized leader was let loose in other parts of the jail where there was people who were less adherent or just day-to-day criminals, they could become radicalized. And so we knew it was going on. We didn't know the significance of it and how it would turn out to be really the birthplace of the Islamic State.
Right. And we're still living with those consequences, as David's book is filled with irony. Another detail here is the sources you develop in Iraq and their names, and they're not all the right names, but they were sometimes interpreters, sometimes friend of interpreters. At the time, did you understand that they were all penetrated? How did you approach them, David? Did you count on their information, or did you believe that they were looking for weaknesses in your defenses? That's why they were being friendly to you.
Yeah, those are situations in which when you handle sources, when you handle informants, those things are always in the front of your mind. And there's a vetting process that you, when given more time than we had, you would go through a fairly lengthy and significant vetting process to ensure that the information they provide is credible. We had little time, and therefore we had to rely more on training and judgment and our linguists. And so when we pulled these guys in and talked to them, we we would caveat and context their information in such a way that allowed us to analyze it for credibility as quick as we could and as reliably as we could.
You're on the road from Basra to Umm Qasr on to Baghdad. Do I have the geography correct? If you're driving from Basra, you'd go through Camp Buka or by Camp Buka?
If you're traveling south from Basra, you would pass by Camp Buka on the way to the border with Iraq and Kuwait.
Right, and that would be the road north to Baghdad, that main highway from Basra
Correct.
To Baghdad.
Correct.
It's about 6 hours' drive. At no point, I knew you didn't get killed, David, because you wrote the book, but that's about the only thing I had confidence of. It felt like the whole base was under assault all the time. Did it feel like that when you were there, that they were looking for a major operation? For example, when that dump truck went missing.
The feeling at Camp Buka was you were sitting on a powder keg, because nobody wanted to address the issue of being in southern Iraq. When I say nobody, high-ranking military, no one wanted to start a war with really the country that had the most presence in southern Iraq, which is Iran. That was where you felt like you were on the edge of a major war if you made the wrong decision. Being at Camp Buka, it wasn't similar to maybe places up north where they were receiving mortar fire on a daily basis. What was more significant at Camp Buka was the feeling of trying to collect information against the threats from Iran outside the base, collect information on Al-Qaeda, who was in your prison, while also not stepping on a, you know, theoretical political landmine that may spark a fight in southern Iraq that would directly involve Iranian forces. That was the delicate balance you had to take. And as I say in the book, intelligence collection, the practice of it is naturally, it's provocation. You are poking into places and talking to people and asking questions that they don't want you to ask. And that didn't suit the situation in southern Iraq at the time, but we had a job to do. So we really tried to thread the needle of collecting the information without sparking a larger geopolitical conflict.
You have an Iraqi named whom you call in the book Mo. Mo at some point starts a Q&A with you, and you learn from him that a man named Al-Sadr has told Mo and all of the rest of them not to work with the Americans or at least be hostile towards the Americans. That's Muki Al-Sadr, the semi-official, semi-religious cleric who commands a major neighborhood in Baghdad. My memory, because, you know, David, I've been at this as long as you have. I just never went to war. I just talked about it. Who would routinely rocket and mortar the American embassy and the American forces in Baghdad. When you learned Al-Sadr's name from Mo, did you understand that was threatening?
Absolutely. When he says Al-Sadr, it tells us two things. Al-Sadr is the face of Shia militantism in Iraq. And the fact that his message was trickling down to southern Iraq, which is the Shia stronghold for the nation, that obviously was construed as a significant threat, to the point that he felt comfortable enough telling people that they shouldn't work with Americans. And he's up in Baghdad, but yet he had the power to send that message down almost to the border with Kuwait. That told us that he had significant sway and had proxies on the ground and the support of Iran in order to pull that off, issue those threats and people follow through and obey or comply at minimum.
I'm going to ask the same matter I asked about Afghanistan. These many years later, you're a veteran of the Iraq War. You were as vulnerable as it gets, David. You know that now. You look back upon it. The U.S. left Baghdad militarily, officially, some years ago during the first Obama administration. There are elements, special forces, there are supply units, all of that still entangled in some fashion. But these many years later, what is your measure of the sacrifice you and your colleagues made for the Iraqi people? Do you believe it was futile? Do you believe it was misdirected, given what's happened, that Iraq is now completely, well, let's put it this way, understood to be under the thumb of Tehran, our enemy?
Unfortunately, I think the execution in Iraq was flawed from the beginning, although at the time we've experienced something in our country with September 11th that was really unparalleled for many generations, especially for my generation. And so the anxious spirit to address it, I think, was needed, or it was natural and understood. But unfortunately, I think the execution in Iraq and the planning was underestimated what the situation was going to be. Now, one thing Iraq did do is attract people like Zarqawi. It attracted the Al-Qaeda types to a location where we could fight. Unfortunately, you hate to just throw away the Iraqi people as if Iraq is just a middle ground that you can fight your enemies on. These are people. These are towns. These are families. So the execution on the front end and the planning was poor in comparison perhaps to other engagements we've been in. But to play devil's advocate, for the administration and for those in government at the time, we were fighting a threat. When you've talked about with networks, with terrorist organizations that have no homeland, they have no central authority. There was a big learning process, and I think that's where we contributed the most, is being able to come out of Iraq and understand the threat that much better, understand Iran, a state, understand their influence in these terrorist networks. Prior to 9/11, we had a rudimentary grasp on that. Coming out of Iraq, despite the poor planning and other things, we came out very educated, very well suited to better address the threat and the nuances within that threat.
The book is Consequences, An Intelligence Officer's War. David Grantham is the author. David is a senior fellow at the Secure Free Society. And when we come back, I'm going to draw on David's experiences in Afghanistan and Iraq, especially with networks of very dangerous, extremely organized people, and how it can begin to interpret what's going on in Central America and South America today with the U.S. as the target. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show, CBS Audio Network.
When you switch to Frontier Gig Service, you don't have to worry about your internet dropping out at the worst possible times. And you can talk to friends and present in work meetings without sounding like this. Seriously, no more of that nonsense. Change to fiber. Change to better. Upgrade to Frontier Gig Service on our 100% fiber network for fast and reliable total home Wi-Fi and get a $200 Visa reward card on us. Exclusive offer for qualified households only. Go to frontier.com/getfiber for complete offer details. Service is subject to availability and all applicable terms and conditions.
Well, with Fast Play, it looks like us coins are just forgotten.
How many times do I have to say it? Fast Play is fun. We get to scratch other games.
I was made to scratch. I should be scratching everything.
If you think I'm going back to the couch cushion, think again. I'm not going back.
No one is going to the couch cushion.
Play fast, win big with Fast Play from the Connecticut Lottery. No coins needed. Please play responsibly. Odds vary by and during games. Must be 18 or older to purchase. CTLottery.org.